The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis with the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article is titled, How to End Our Affair with Systemic Capitalism. Malika Jabali always knew she wanted to use her voice and her legal skills to question societal norms that stood against marginalized voices. As a graduate of Columbia Law School and a licensed attorney, she put her passion for policy implementation toward creating a platform for change for herself and her community. Along with her work as the senior news and politics editor at Essence and her editorial presence in publications like Teen Vogue, The New Republic, Very Smart Brothers, Jacob, and The Guardian, she is now taking her message to another medium. Her first book, It's Not You, It's Capitalism, Why It's Time to Break Up and How to Move On, debuting on October 24th, is an illustrated guide to embracing socialism with stories that center revolutionaries of color. In this excerpt, she shares, for us to dump capitalism like a toxic ex, once and for all. Okay, we're making progress. You left that abusive job and got a union position at a company that tries to share decision-making collectively and actually respects everyone's time. You start getting over the past, being all healthy and going out more, running out of pages in your passport, and then, boom, your ex slides into your DMs. Again, it's like they have an antenna that knows when you've gotten over them and gotten it together, and they whine about you going to places they think you don't belong. This is what all those ads decrying Medicare for All felt like during the 2020 election. They are the Drake in our lives, raising a fit because we are trying to move on. We were bombarded with multi-million dollar campaigns telling us that life couldn't possibly be better with public health care. There would be no choice and no freedom, precisely because so many people were finally so over America's current for-profit healthcare system. Even while pundits have always framed Medicare for All as a radical idea in the 2020 Democratic primary in South Carolina, a state widely known for its radical left revolutionaries and communists, more voters supported replacing all private health insurance with a single government plan for everyone than those who opposed it. The idea of free government-funded health care is growing in popularity, but as with many of our social services, we can only have good things in limited ways or in temporary spurts, with the ever-looming threat that they will end. Probably like how Jimmy Brooks felt when his basketball dreams were dashed halfway into the season. But maybe we can eventually get that good Dutch healthcare and piece it back together, like Jimmy did in those later Degrassi seasons. We're not lacking universal free public health care in order to teach us all personal responsibility. The government's reason for limiting our social safety net is often framed this way, as if we are children without self-control who needs a gazillion-dollar hospital bill and a choice of insurers to be real adults, even though most people have no real choice. Their employers likely offer one insurance provider and two or three plans tops. Oh, and the unemployed are screwed, obviously. Single-payer health care is one way to ensure everyone has access to necessary services under one plan. As the Black Panther Party put it in their program platform back in March of 1972, we believe that the government must provide free of charge for the people health facilities that will not only treat our illnesses, most of which are a result of our oppression, but that will also develop preventative medical programs to guarantee our future survival. It's way past time. The next article is titled, Writers in Charge, Shortchanged on Revenue, Cut Out of Royalties, and Threatened with Replacement by Artificial Intelligence are on the front lines in a fight for their careers. On May 2, 2023, thousands of writers took to picket lines in front of studios and sound stages in New York and Los Angeles. They were expressing displeasure with working conditions and unfair pay standards after 6 weeks of ongoing but fruitless negotiations with studio and streaming executives. The Writers Guild of America, WGA, clashed with the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, AMPTP, over contract standards, royalties, AI use, and new constrained standards in the writing room that have become normalized in the wake of the streaming boom. On its official Strike Hub site, the WGA asserted that studios have taken advantage of the transition to streaming to underpay entertainment industry workers, including writers in every area of work. While the news that some of our favorite fall shows and streaming darlings would be placed on indefinite pause bummed out many a viewer, it seemed at first that only a handful of casual consumers completely grasped the issues at hand. Was this, they wondered, just a case of rich people fighting even richer people for more money? But despite the general public's assumptions about the cushy lives of Hollywood storytellers, the average television writer generally lives a somewhat meager financial existence, and the conditions that have pushed them to the picket lines are not sustainable long term. The residuals have come down. The pay has gone down. Everything's gone, says Gina Yashir, co-creator and co-showrunner of the hit CBS sitcom Bob Hurts Abishola. Yashir has been focusing on stand-up and touring since her show went dark. With the new streamers, there is even less money because these shows have fewer episodes. You're getting 4-episode seasons, 6-episode seasons, and 8-episode seasons, which is not enough money to maintain you around the year. With shows now huddling their scribes into short-staffed writing pods in 6 or 10 week increments, paying them a set amount per week or per delivered episode, and signing them to exclusivity clauses that can last months on end, what may seem like a lucrative gig assignment, let's say $5,000 a week for 2 months' time, often ends up having to last them through an entire year or even longer, until the show resumes production of a new season or they are able to secure a new contract. Right now, writers are struggling. They're driving Ubers, they're working in Target, says Yashir. They're turning up to the Emmys with bow ties and tuxedos they've had to borrow money to wear because they can't really afford to live in Los Angeles and New York, where business is primarily taking place. Of course, stretching $40,000 to cover all expenses in major cities where the low-income line notoriously touches about $65,000 is still better than having little to no income at all. As such, the ongoing strike is hitting writers where it hurts the most. Their already stretched thin pockets. It seems the AMPTP is looking to exploit this fact to its full advantage, despite already denying writers proper payment and opportunities for advancement in the face of new standards and practices. Under streaming, reports claim that industry decision makers are planning to let the strike period drag on until it forces compliance among unionized writers. A Deadline report released on July 11th quoted an anonymous studio executive as saying that the AMPTP plans to, quote, unquote, break the WGA by stalling negotiation talks at least through mid-fall, specifically until union members begin to lose apartments and to default on their mortgages. Unsurprisingly, writers of color are being hit the hardest by the AMPT's refusal to budge. Those who've already got their foot in the door of a tough-to-crack industry are being affected. But the newer creators with dreams of writing for the screen are in for an even tougher battle. Regardless of what outcomes may be reached once the picket signs are finally down and television sets are buzzing again, I don't want to sugarcoat it, so I'll just state it plain. Black and brown writers are screwed, and it's going to be harder than ever before to break in, says Tracy Oliver, writer and creator of BET's Plus First Wives Club and Amazon Prime Video's Harlem. Her own eight-figure overall deal with Apple has been placed on pause indefinitely due to the strike's kickoff. I would say in the last 5 years, we saw a big boom in diverse content and diverse creators getting deals, getting showrunner jobs, and finally getting into the position of hiring other people of color. She continues, when I first started, which was 2 years after the last writer's strike, there were just no jobs for writers of color. There was no Scandal, no How to Get Away with Murder. There was no Atlanta, no Insecure. There was nothing with black people on the air at that moment. The 2008 writers' strike lasted 100 days and is widely credited with the industry-wide push toward reality and unscripted television that has shaped the entertainment landscapes to this day. And while the last half decade has seen networks, studios, and streamers warm to the concept of stories told by and about people from marginalized communities, Oliver believes the fallout of this strike will have additional and dire long-term effects for black writers once creators are back to work, as production companies seek to recoup their losses. Now, if you haven't already made an impact, it's going to be almost impossible to work, Oliver says. I don't think people realize that black and brown people are going to be really, really hurting after this, because there's just not going to be the content on the air. The first things that they've pulled so far have all been diverse. That's where they start. It's a sentiment that Yashir echoes. Whenever the purse strings get cut, it's always people of color and women that get dumped first. LGBTQ+ that get dumped next, but always black women and people of color first, she says. If we don't strike and fight for those rights to be paid properly, we will be driven out of the industry. It'll become the enclave of rich tech bros, mainly white people with trust funds who can afford to just intern and work for nothing because they've already got family money or tech money. We will return to the days where every story was told by white men. And we will lose access to different stories told by different voices because those voices will not be able to afford to work in the industry. With the end of the strike at least several months down the line, and with the Screen Actors Guild American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, SAG-AFTRA, actors joining the protest action as of July 14th, this has now become the most impactful industry-wide strike in over 60 years. Oliver is frank about the fact that regardless of the end result, the historic event marks a turning point for black entertainment creators. The outcome that black people are hoping for is not going to happen, she says. I hate to say that, but I hear a lot that the hope is when we come out of this, we'll get more jobs. For the vast majority, the deal is not going to help. The reason is, whenever a studio or a corporation pays more money, they take it out of something. They're never going to lose their own profits. They're just going to offset it, which means, okay, cool, so we're no longer going to make Harlem, or we're no longer going to make this black show, or this show starring Hispanics, or this show with a gay lead. They're going to offset it in ways that hurt us. With studios viewing content catering to and created by people of color as most expendable, black writers don't have much recourse in an industry that's already sketchy about including them. What I keep encouraging writers to do is not necessarily beg corporations for jobs because they don't care about us, Oliver says. You're either going to have to figure out a way around it or concede to the fact that maybe writing isn't an option for making a living. I know that's really bleak, but that's the truth. There are not going to be enough jobs for all of us. Harkening back to her own experience with producing The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl alongside Issa Rae for YouTube as a way to bypass the studio system, Oliver believes a pivot to more entrepreneurial thinking and alternative distribution channels may be the saving grace for black creators hungry to get their ideas to the masses. We could all win together if we strategize and thought about what everybody brings to the table and how we can all work together, she says. There are people that have what you don't have, and then you bring something that they don't have. There's a way for us to partner up and all profit and win together if we did things outside the system. There are some positives in that and a lot of great storytelling and great opportunities that can come out of it. The next article is titled From Harlem with Love. The founder of Harlem's Fashion Row, Brandis Daniel, has dedicated her career to helping up and coming designers to be seen, heard, and monetized. Rule breaker, cultural disruptor, fashion outsider. These are just some of the words people use to describe Brandis Daniel, who's considered a pioneer of the fashion industry and a style icon in her own right. As the founder of Harlem's Fashion Row, affectionately known as HFR, she has poured her blood, sweat, and tears into creating opportunities and economic value for up-and-coming designers of color. She starts by providing them with a platform that brings their creations to the masses. The Memphis native created her organization in 2007, offering a place where underrepresented designers could be apprenticed, respected, and more widely recognized. Since then, her impact has been significant. We'll try to give you a few of her credits. She spearheaded a first-of-its-kind collaboration between HFR, Nike, and LeBron James to create the first LeBron basketball shoe designed by and for women. She started a nonprofit organization, Icon 360, which has donated more than $2 million to HBCU fashion departments and black designers. And she has championed designers of color through major corporate partnerships with companies such as Target Corp, Macy's Inc., CoverGirl, Pandora Jewelry, and Coca-Cola. Even more impressive, this force of nature has done this all while putting Harlem's rich legacy of fashion and cultural style front and center. We've finally got to a place where the fashion industry realizes that all voices need to be heard at the table, says Daniel. They're very aware of it, but the economy is tough right now, and so I think we are at a crossroads because there is a feeling that brands might go back to the status quo, to what has been. And so we are at a place where we are having to be the voice that reminds fashion brands that this work is still incredibly important and that this isn't the time to stop all of the progress that we have made over the last few years. It's why Daniel fights on. While there have certainly been shifts within the industry, they have inspired her not only to help designers gain more exposure, but also to provide them access to capital building opportunities. As an extension of HFR, her mentorship vision has become much bigger and bolder, leading her to found Icon 360 to create funding opportunities for BIPOC designers who were underrepresented in fashion. Hold up, wait a minute. Y'all thought she was finished? The revolution will not only be televised, it will be recorded in the history of fashion for years to come. Earlier this year, Daniel released her first book, Fashion in Color, Volume 1, HFR's tribute to black fashion designers and the 50th anniversary of hip hop. The book comes at the perfect time to lavishly illustrate how these two cultural movements are intertwined and how they ripple across generations. She recognizes the swagger that style icon Dapper Dan infused into the rap game, and the genius of Missa Hylton, who made a name for herself during the peak 90s R&B hip-hop, styling some of New York's most influential artists. We have to preserve our own history, says Daniel. And it can't all be online. We need books that are published and in the Library of Congress so that when people look back 50 years from now, 75 years from now, 100 years from now, they'll be able to see all the black designers who contributed to this industry. And that's why we released Fashion in Color. And we said Volume 1 because even though we included black designers A to Z, we couldn't possibly get in all the designers we really wanted to feature in one book. Danielle's contributions are more than deserving of the recognition she's getting. But when asked if she feels she's received proper credit, she acknowledges that fashion is not an industry designed to promote mainstream success for people who look like her. I expect nothing from the fashion industry for me personally. She says nothing. I don't look to the fashion industry to define my value, she continues. I don't look to it to give me my value, period. I didn't come into this needing credit from the industry. Unfortunately, I think a lot of people do seek that sort of recognition, and it can be really disappointing and disheartening for the people that come into this industry wanting to get something like credit and validation from it. As for what's next, the marathon continues. This September marks HFR's 16th annual fashion show. Among the honorees this year are Haitian-Italian designer Stella Jean and Los Angeles-based styling duo Wayman Bannerman and Mackay McDonald. Ever the visionary, Danielle is already looking to the future and imagining consumers being a part of her signature event as well. The next article is titled Styling with the Stars. Members of Team Essence applaud these celebs' bold fashion choices. My inspiration is the Tracee Ellis Ross. Not only is she super glam and sophisticated, but her fashion is such a reflection of what black women are. Bold, unique, sexy, and just fly. Stephanie Donovan, VP Branded Content and Video. My sister island girl, Rihanna, brings the fire every time, whether she's making a statement at the Met Gala, dancing on a float at Carnival, or just going about her business as a mom-to-be. Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Avra Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.